You ain't got no problem, Jules. I'm on the motherfucker. Go back in there and chill them out. And wait for the wolf, who should be coming directly.
You sending the wolf?
Who's that?
That's Beaumont.
Who's Beaumont?
An employee I had to let go.
Bill shot you in the head, no?
Yes.
I would have been much nicer. If we had just cut your face.
Such an old story. It's a scene, man. Memorize it. What? Look, man, an undercover cop's gotta be Marlon Brando, man. To do this job, you gotta be a great actor. You gotta be naturalistic. You gotta be naturalistic as hell.
Do I frighten you? Is it my scar?
It's your car.
Yeah, I know. Sorry.
Well, if this is it, old boy, I hope you don't mind if I go out speaking to Kings.
By all means, Captain.
Maybe that boy in blue here can answer some of these questions about this rat business you've been talking about.
You're a piece of work, my friend.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I break your concentration? I didn't mean to do that. Please, continue.
So what, you left her there?
I shot her.
You shot Melanie?
Twice, in the parking lot.
If you still respectfully refuse, I'm calling the bear at you, over. He's going to take that big bat of his, and he's going to beat your ass to death with it.
Wiggle your big toe.
From Tuscaloosa, Alabama, this is Aspect Radio. I'm Corey Kraft.
And I'm Ben Flanagan. Welcome to another episode of the show. And Andrew, our producer, Andrew Richardson, is going to be joining us a little bit today, and we're going to have some parting shots from the regulars from the filmnerds.com crew, so stay tuned for that. We are definitely going to return to Middle Earth, as so many have done, with Peter Jackson's first installment of his Hobbit trilogy, An Unexpected Journey. But first off, we want to head to the West and the South in Quentin Tarantino's latest feature film, Django Unchained. And this is what he calls a Southern, not quite a Western, in the vein of his favorite Western filmmakers, Sergio Leone, Sergio Corbucci, and even a little Sam Peckinpah sprinkled in there, perhaps. This is the story of a German bounty hunter who enlists the help of a slave named Django, here played by Jamie Foxx, to help him capture some of the outlaws that he, as a bounty hunter, is out to get. And as they do that, he enlists him as a fellow bounty hunter, and then they go on a path to find Jamie Foxx's wife, whom he has been separated from. She is a slave of Calvin Candy, who is played by Leonardo DiCaprio, a plantation owner in Mississippi, and so they set forth on this journey to find Broomhilda, as she's named, and sort of save the day, as it were. Now, Corey, a lot has already been said about Django Unchained. We're a little late to the conversation. I saw this on Christmas Day, you the day after, Andrew, just recently. Part of the conversation, or as it's being steered lately, is that Tarantino is on a new path as a filmmaker, and some feel that he might have even regressed, even though technically there's little you can really gripe about when it comes to his movies. They talk about these stories and the weight of these stories, and certainly the subject matter of these films have grown in terms of stakes and the weight that I'm talking about here. You're talking about Inglourious Basterds, where you have the Holocaust and sort of reshaping the history and telling these alternate versions of how history plays out, where the Jews fight back and sort of take Hitler and Goebbels and other Nazi people out, or Nazis out. Now, with Django Unchained, he takes on slavery, and he puts the six shooters in the hands of a slave and gives him the power to fight back against these evil, white, slave-owning, just horrible villains. So, yes, you have a larger scope and greater weight to these topics that they're attacking, but some would say with these revenge fantasies, the movies bear sort of a weightlessness, and while they are dealing with serious subject matter, they don't feel as heavy as some of his movies in the past have felt because of the sort of light nature and comical, fantastic scope he's choosing to tell them. Would you say that Django Unchained does that, and would you say that his work now feels lighter compared to his earlier stuff like Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, which had such an impact on filmmaking?
I don't think lighter is the right
word for that, because, you know, looking back at Reservoir Dogs, it's a well-made crime thriller. Pulp Fiction is exactly what its title suggests, and the Kill Bill movies are trifles. They're kick-ass trifles, but they're hardly dealing with weighty real-world themes. I think that as far as weight, you know, in the term that I think you mean and a lot of film critics mean, Django Unchained is quite weighty, burdening itself with this sort of legacy of racism in the American South and the real-life atrocities that were committed during the time of slavery. You know, Inglourious Basterds took upon itself some of that as well when dealing with the Holocaust and the legacy of Nazi Germany, but again, that movie avoided depicting the horrors of the Holocaust in a lot of ways. You get that one scene at the beginning where Hans Landa comes to Shoshana's family's house, or rather the French farmer who's protecting them, and they're murdered, but that's about as far into the sort of depiction of Nazi atrocities as you get in Inglourious Basterds. In Django Unchained, the atrocity of slavery is displayed in full. You get a great sense of not only our villain, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, but most tertiary white characters in the movie and the racism that pervades their lives and the violence that they're ready to inflict upon African-American slaves at a moment's notice just because it doesn't really mean anything to them. So I think that Django Unchained is perhaps the Tarantino movie that most head-on deals with, I guess, a realistic violence or a more realistic depiction of atrocity. Of course, in the shootouts and the various stylized bits of violence in Django Unchained, they're very over the top, almost Kill Bill-like in their depictions of bloodletting. You know, people give up about a gallon of blood when they're shot by a bullet in this movie. But then you have scenes of violence against slaves that are not stylized. The whippings and the lashings and the man-on-man fights that Calvin Candy orchestrates and you know, a scene of very high tension involving an escaped slave from Calvin Candy's plantation. Those scenes are depicted not reverently, but certainly without the stylization that I think you could point to a lot of his films as featuring, even his earlier films like Pulp Fiction. I think Reservoir Dogs is pretty grounded in its human violence too. So I think that critics who accuse Tarantino of not really delving into the weight of this very real and very hard-to-accept past are doing this film a disservice, because I think he's doing exactly that, but he's sort of framing it in one of his empowerment narratives, such as Inglourious Basterds, as you said. He's using the cinema to sort of do his part to rewrite history and to give what power he can to the downtrodden and to the historically powerless. And what you have with Django Unchained is subsequently a revenge narrative that it doesn't rewrite history, but it almost seems like atonement in some ways from a white filmmaker who certainly feels that burden and that guilt. And I don't think that it's weightless at all, really.
Well, and so did you like the movie?
I did, very much. As far as Tarantino's filmography, it certainly fits right in there. You know, a lot has been said of virtually all of his films mixing his interests. You have a healthy heaping of the blaxploitation film and the spaghetti western sort of mixed together in a pot, with surprisingly some more contemporary elements to this film as all. A lot of the music choices are atypically for Tarantino, modern music choices. I think there are some original songs written for this film, not only by Ennio Morricone, which of course I don't think really counts as far as a contemporary original song, but you have a lot of modern artists like John Legend and Rick Ross contributing selections to the soundtrack. So stylistically, of course, it fits right on in there, and it's filled with his trademark excellent writing, scenes of that may seem extended but feature great tension, you know, terrific performances, particularly from Christoph Waltz in one of the co-lead roles, and Jamie Foxx is wonderfully subdued. You know, it's a performance that I didn't really expect from him. He has this sort of, I don't know, larger-than-life persona that he tampered nicely in this sort of Eastwood-like man-with-no-name role of Django. And of course, as the villains of the piece, Leonardo DiCaprio and Samuel L. Jackson as his main house slave, Stephen, come very close to stealing the movie. It is really terrific. It's, you know, another terrific Tarantino movie, which, coming from me, I guess, seems kind of expected, but but I think it is very good.
Yeah, Tarantino lately obviously has been catching a little flack from another public figure and filmmaker with whom he has a bit of a history regarding African Americans depicted in film in what this guy feels is a negative way. And this is Spike Lee, of course, who had issue with how often Tarantino used the N-word in Jackie Brown back in 1997.
Yeah, and if I can get off on a little sidebar here about that, I don't think that Lee's criticism over that in Jackie Brown and Pulp Fiction, particularly Pulp Fiction, in which Tarantino himself is the character who sort of overuses that word for no real reason, I don't think that's unwarranted. And I think that as far as things maybe Tarantino wishes he might could have back, maybe that scene is one of them. I certainly wish he had had another shot. Of course, I wish he would rethink every time he appears in any of his movies, as I'm sure we'll talk about. I don't think that that particular criticism of Tarantino is unwarranted necessarily. But then again, in Django Unchained, it's all about historical context. So I think maybe he should see the movie.
I think it works really well in Django Unchained. My biggest problem with this criticism is that he hasn't seen the movie, and he has no basis for saying what he says about it. I think it works really well in the context of the film.
But you have to also wonder, had Pulp Fiction and Jackie Brown never happened, would Spike Lee feel the same way about Django Unchained right now and what he had heard about the N-word being used so rampantly in the movie? And yes, it is about historical context, but another larger question that I would ask, based on Spike Lee and other people's criticisms about Django Unchained, having seen it or not seen it, should movies depicting Nazi and slavery atrocities as they are in Django Unchained and Inglourious Basterds, should these movies be fun? Or should they be treated with the same, I guess, stark seriousness and reverence as we've seen in films like Schindler's List or other films, very few films that have depicted slavery with the brutal honesty that something like Django Unchained does, but he treats it like an adventure movie. This is a film that really, when you boil it down, it's kind of like Super Mario Brothers in a way. It's got the same story arc where you have the hero going to rescue the princess who's trapped in the evil villain's lair or castle. That's what this is about, and this parallels a German myth that Christoph Waltz's character brings up. But look, I love this film. I think it's great. It's as entertaining as any Tarantino movie has been so far. And like you said, it fits snugly into his filmography. But you have to sort of catch yourself watching it. And as often as the N-word is used in this movie, as I was watching this in a full theater, there's laughter from the audience so many times when it's used, especially by a character like Samuel Jackson, who, for better or worse, is depicted as this Uncle Tom type house slave who adheres to every single command his owner and his master gives him, but he obviously has ulterior motives in terms of how he's treating other slaves. So he's working on several different levels. You have this facade that he puts on in front of Calvin Candy that certainly is unmasked at a key point in the movie, and everything sort of changes for that character and the rest of the entire film. And what I think is a brilliant performance and my favorite in the movie. But what I love about what Tarantino is doing in these revenge fantasies that are taking on this weighty subject matter is that he, with his sense of humor, this is a guy who can obviously laugh at anything and talk about anything in these films. He's forcing us to look at these things and look at these dark parts of here American history and in Inglourious Basterds, international history, just world history in general. He's forcing us to look at it. And if an adventure movie or a heist film or an action film is how we're going to face these brutal honesties of our history and our culture, then I say all the better, because we're learning about it, albeit in a story that tells it in an altered way. But you have to look at this and you have to say, well, these things did actually happen. And yeah, the violence is stylized in terms of how the violence is dished out to the white slave owners, but not so much. And I think that that is where Tarantino's reverence to history comes in when you're dealing with the black characters.
I think if you told Tarantino you can't approach the Holocaust or slavery without taking a very serious approach to it, he just wouldn't make the films. That's not Tarantino's style. That's not what he does. Mm-hmm. We need somebody out there who can take these terrible pieces of history and make them fun and make them interesting and do something different with them. We don't need every single movie that is about the Holocaust or slavery to be a lesson or to be preaching at us about how bad it is. At this point, most of us get it. Not everybody, sure, but that's not Tarantino's job is to preach to everybody. His job is to make an entertaining and oftentimes very funny film.
Well, I also think a lot of the point here is that a traditional, I guess, more, I don't know, serious depiction of the atrocities in the Holocaust and slavery are by definition not empowering to Jewish audiences or to African-American audiences, just because it's, you know, a straight depiction of what happened. It's awful. And you have these two groups subjugated and brutalized. You know, Inglourious Basterds and Django Unchained take that and they put the power back into the victims. And they say, you know, in as much as I can do anything with a film, here is a film that tries to recapture, you know, some sort of power or control over this situation. It's not, you know, it's fiction, of course, but a lot of what Tarantino's doing in Django Unchained is he's taking the standard language and the standard imagery and iconography of the Western and of, you know, a sort of, well, specifically, I guess, the Western, and he is reconfiguring it to fit a black audience in Jamie Foxx. It's not a coincidence that the film basically closes, and this isn't really a spoiler, on Gene Autry's horse tricks, or that Jamie Foxx dresses like the man with no name at a point or two in this film. Tarantino is sort of reclaiming a lot of this imagery and repurposing it as a symbol of black empowerment, which I think is important. And the fact that it's fun and not, you know, an overly serious treatment of slavery. Well, I mean, obviously there are a ton of those films. But as far as putting power back in the hands of an African-American figure at a point in history where an African-American figure would probably not have that much power, it's light and entertaining because the alternative is completely contrary to his goals.
And there's nothing wrong with asking, well, what would have happened if... And that's what these movies do. But well, then you have to wonder, yeah, well, is this making Tarantino feel better? Is this film a result of his own white guilt that he may have been carrying throughout his entire life? And does it make him feel better? How are African Americans supposed to feel just because this white filmmaker felt bad about it and thought, well, what if this had happened? Does this make you feel empowered? Does this make you feel better? This isn't exactly what actually happened. This is a revenge that we are able to live out for 2.5 hours. And then we get back to the real world and think, well, that would have been great, but it ain't what happened.
Well, I mean, quite apart from sort of intellectualizing it, it's badass. It's
yeah, just, it is.
I mean, it's a really fun movie to watch. It's very entertaining. And, you know, so much that this subject is not off limits to making a movie like that. I mean, Tarantino pushes it to the boundary here of where this sort of movie can go. And I think he's very successful with it. And I think that it's entertaining, if only anecdotally, from my point of view. You know, the audience that I saw it with was very mixed demographically. Younger and older black and white couples all seeing the movie and all seeming to enjoy it quite a bit. And, you know, as a Southern white male, even, there's something about the experience of seeing Django Unchained that's fairly cathartic even for me.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of a divestment of a fairly shameful history for a lot of, you know, people who, I mean, I don't think anybody in my family was ever wealthy enough to own a plantation, but the fact is that lineage-wise, I think that a lot of us can trace our family origins back to somebody who probably did some things that we would not be proud of today. And it's probably for the best that my ancestor was not gunned down brutally, but the fact that you're sort of seeing this sort of Southern demon exercised in whatever way cinema can provide that, I think is cathartic in some ways for some people. I mean, it's not necessarily a legacy that troubles me every day. It might be if I were an African American, because I honestly can't put myself in those shoes. But as far as remaining empathetic, I think that the Django Unchained does a really admirable job at that. It's sort of providing this sense of empathy and this sense of, skewed though it is, weight in history.
Yeah, and considering that it is one of the darkest hours or eras of American history, why don't they get to live out that fantasy? They get to live out whatever fantasy they want to, they should. It is an atrocity, and it's despicable. And yeah, we're from this geographically. We're a part of this history, whether we like it or not. And yeah, we, like I said, I mean, if it's a film, despite how it's presented and how it's framed, if it gets people thinking about it again, considering they didn't learn much about it in high school or middle school or even elementary school. I know I certainly didn't.
It's not a subject that
you don't spend a lot of time on it.
Yeah,
unfortunately, unless watching Glory Amistad one day, yeah, in your history class, that's all well and good. But that, you know, I'm not sure what kind of message that really sends to you.
Yeah, Glory finds the exception rather than the rule.
Well, I happen to love Glory.
I mean, it's a good movie.
Yeah. But
for what it is,
still, I mean, when your substitute is there and presses play, that's right. Not really the right way to learn about the Civil War and slavery and the atrocities of what happened in the South. But we need more movies like this, I think. We need more movies about slavery. We need more books written about it. We need people to learn about it however they possibly can. And it is kind of interesting to see it, again, presented in this way through the eyes of Tarantino, a guy who has been so enamored with black culture all his life. This is someone who's obsessed with blaxploitation films and someone who grew up watching all kinds of movies and obviously wanted to make one himself and now has and has cast black actors and used black music in his films forever. This is a guy who, on the record, hates certain films and filmmakers because of their politics and because of their history concerning race relations. Guys like John Ford, films like Birth of a Nation. I mean, it really gets his goat, and to see him sort of get it all off of his chest with films like Django Unchained is certainly entertaining. And talking about the film itself, aside from the politics and sort of singling out some of the performances, I singled out Samuel Jackson as my favorite in the movie. Tarantino, ever since, you could say Reservoir Dogs, but really Pulp Fiction, has this reputation for being a director to pull these forgotten actors mm-hmm. from irrelevance and reintroducing them as guys who have these chops that were just never really utilized or hadn't been in a long time. And to me, he does that with Samuel Jackson in this movie. This is a guy who, in my opinion, hasn't tried and has phoned in his performances for a long time. It's really been a while since Samuel Jackson has really given us something to chew on and has really dominated a role like he does in Django Unchained. This is his best performance in a long time, and again, my favorite in the movie.
I don't disagree with that. I mean, it's not as if Samuel L. Jackson has fallen into irrelevance by any means. He was just in the highest grossing film of the year, of course, as one member of that ensemble, The Avengers. Yeah, I mean, that film didn't really require him to do anything but his typical Sam Jackson thing. This film stretches him quite a bit and brings him out of his comfort zone, and you're right, it is his most effective performance in a very long time.
I think it's good because it's unexpected to a certain extent. Like you said, he hasn't really gone away. He's been doing the Sam Jackson character for a long time in a lot of different movies, and to have him sort of come back in this movie and be like, you know, when he first appeared on screen, I was worried, like, oh man, Sam Jackson's just going to ruin this movie by being Sam Jackson, and within, you know, 5 minutes, my mouth was shut. I was like, oh, I was wrong. Sorry. And he was great. I agree. He was probably, I don't know if he's my favorite. I really liked Christoph Waltz.
Yeah, I think Christoph Waltz is my favorite performer.
But I think that's partially just because I really like Christoph Waltz. But yeah, I mean, he totally steals the show a number of times throughout the movie, and his performance was excellent.
I'd probably go back to Jackie Brown, to be honest with you, or Unbreakable. He's had a couple of good things sprinkled here and there, like Black Snake Moan.
Yeah, that
is
would
really
be,
great.
That'd be the one that
performance.
I would see.
But the guy's made like 100 movies mm-hmm. since the late 90s.
He's enduringly popular, but you know, he's enduringly popular because of who he is,
right?
And the standard sort of shtick that he brings to each performance.
I just haven't really felt that unpredictability that I did with Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, where these films strike this raw nerve that you haven't really gotten to experience in a movie. You have, again, this unpredictability and this heightened tension in Inglourious Basterds in the first scene and the tavern scene. I can't say I felt that as much in this movie, where you have these characters who are playing their hands very quietly and close to the vest, and they hate to reveal them. And you do have these scenes like the dinner table scene once they're on Candyland and they're having dinner with Calvin Candy, and they're negotiating these Mandingo fighters, and they're carrying on, as Christoph Waltz puts, this charade the whole time. This movie is essentially about acting too. Mm-hmm. They're playing these characters and how important it is, you know, not to break character. And I think that's really interesting. But you're right, Christoph Waltz is great again. under Tarantino's direction. It fits like a glove for him. And you mentioned Jamie Foxx. I thought it was a great performance.
Yeah.
It's so contained, I think self-contained and so under the radar. And I think that, yeah, Tarantino's probably intention was for him to go for that Man With No Name quality. But Jamie Foxx is a guy whose career has really benefited from his skill as someone who has these flashy tools and is electrifying in some of the roles and some of the things that he has done throughout his career. But here he's just so subdued. And I think that he plays Django with so much integrity, and this is a guy who's been through so much and is finally able to challenge the system and watch this Dr. Schultz character sort of challenge the system in front of him and show him, here's what you can do. Mm-hmm. Those early scenes are really what do it for me with Jamie Foxx's performance.
And then you've got, of course, DiCaprio. I think when he was cast in the sort of Tarantino villain role that has garnered so much acclaim for other actors, people were pretty excited about the notion of DiCaprio sinking his teeth into one of those roles. And I think he acquits himself nicely as this prissy, entitled, and stupider than he thinks he is, plantation owner Calvin Candy, who has a couple of really like tense and very volatile moments. You know, I don't think the performance surprised me. You know, it wasn't like Christoph Waltz in Inglourious Basterds where you didn't know what to expect from this guy because he was a new performer. I kind of knew exactly what DiCaprio was going to do with it, and then he didn't disappoint, which is in itself a bit not disappointing exactly, but it didn't seem as fresh, I guess, as a lot of the past Tarantino villains have, just because, I mean, while DiCaprio is a great actor and while I think he gives a very, very good performance in this film, I don't think it was a really revelatory one.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
I think in some ways it is, because DiCaprio is sort of given this opportunity to, yeah, like you said, sink his teeth into a certain kind of role he's never really played. I read that this is the first time in like 16 years where he hasn't been the lead.
Yeah, he hasn't
in
been
his
top billed
film. And I've always been sort of curious to see him in a supporting role or in a villainous role. Was the last supporting role he had was probably, what, Celebrity, the Woody Allen
movie?
Yeah, I think
so. And then
he was in What's Eating Gilbert Grape early in his career. Two great performances. And just to sort of give him something on the side to do, I think would have been interesting where he wasn't able to dominate a film. But I think the scenes he is in, he does sort of dominate them, and he is very good. And it's an extremely interesting and juicy role for a guy like DiCaprio to take on. And there's a key stretch in this movie where they're sort of on this, the ride to Candyland, mm-hmm. where I think DiCaprio is especially good. And there's a sequence which I think is a key sequence within that, and which is key for the entire film, involving this character named D'Artagnan, who has attempted to escape. He's one of the Mandingo fighters that they're maybe trading, or just at least, you know, he's one of these men, these slaves, who they're forcing to fight to the death in what may or may not be a true fact about American history. I've not seen that confirmed anywhere.
I think I kind of doubt that. I mean, I'm sure that
it's
that
a direct reference.
Happened, but the name itself is a reference to another film,
right?
So,
but it's an amazing scene, and I think it's a great example of what DiCaprio does with this character, this menacing, like you said, stupider than he seems, but he in some ways is a good businessman and has so much power and knows how to use it and knows how to intimidate when he needs to. Mm-hmm. And it's an awful sequence, but it's one that permeates for the rest of the film for other characters, especially Christoph Waltz, and leads him to make decisions he wouldn't normally make later in the movie, and has a really powerful effect.
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
But I'm at a point now where I do want to rank Tarantino's films. You know, I want to see, where does Django Unchained rank for me? And I was sort of going through it, and it's probably in the middle somewhere for me with his films, where I have two clear movies at the bottom.
Yeah, you do, which I think is weird.
Well, are they not clearly at the bottom for you as well? For me,
no. I mean, Death Proof might be, but Volume 2 is not.
It's not. Okay. Well, for me, here's how I would probably rank these films right now. And I've only seen this movie one time.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to do this after only taking this movie in once, but I'll play along.
Well, I think the only place it could really go is up, to be honest with you. So for me, it's Reservoir Dogs, which is my favorite movie of all time. Then I go Kill Bill Volume 1. And then I probably go Inglourious Basterds. And then I go Pulp Fiction. And then I probably go Django Unchained after that.
It's funny how like I love all of these movies, but I would rank them completely differently, because my favorite Tarantino film is Jackie Brown, followed by Inglourious Basterds, followed by Pulp Fiction, followed by Reservoir Dogs, followed by Volume 1, followed by Volume 2, and then Django.
Hmm. So Django, for now,
is near the bottom.
Near the bottom.
Yeah.
But more time with it.
More time, you never know.
Yeah.
Because as much as I enjoy the Kill Bill films, they've been sort of falling in my estimation, and some of his other films have sort of risen. But it's been so long since I've seen Reservoir Dogs or Pulp Fiction from start to finish that it's kind of hard to do this sort of thing right now.
Mm-hmm. To me,
I do want to see Django Unchained again, of course.
To me, they all sort of float in the cloud in the top of my head, where any given day, it's a different ranking. You know, if I'm in the mood for something like Pulp Fiction, then it's higher on my list. And if I'm in the mood for something like Reservoir Dogs or something like Kill Bill, it just really depends, you know, on my mood.
And I think that's
more than some sort of constant list that I keep.
I think that's a good point. I think that's probably the same for me, even though I think that Jackie Brown is, for whatever reason, my favorite of his films. And it has been for a really long time. You know, it speaks to, I guess, a maturity that it's not that he hasn't displayed in his other movies, but he embraces it, I think, in Jackie Brown a little more.
Well, it's hard. It's kind of like ranking Pixar's movies.
Yeah.
You know, it's just kind of an impossible feat. So that speaks to the quality of his filmography. But speaking of which, do you like where Tarantino is going as a filmmaker? People would say that he peaked early, obviously, with mm-hmm. Reservoir Dogs and then especially Pulp Fiction, which changed the landscape, changed the game for so many people.
Right.
And it's not like the guy has made bad movies ever since then, but people would probably contend that in some ways he's regressed since Pulp Fiction. And it's not really fair to have the expectation that you're going to get Pulp Fiction every single time. He's going to do something differently. And I think that was incredibly unfair leading up to Jackie Brown mm-hmm. in particular. Because once people didn't get that, they just sort of brushed it off as, well, that one wasn't Pulp Fiction. That one was slower and boring. And 7 or 8 years later, we got Kill Bill Volume 1, and you get this sort of resurgence of Tarantino fandom when he has this more fast-paced adventure, something that I think we're a little more used to preceding Jackie Brown. But I don't know. I feel like Kill Bill sort of served as an appropriate transition for his filmography. Ever since Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, and Jackie Brown, when he had that long gap, you had this revenge fantasy with all the references and all the stylized types of mechanics he applied to it and the music and things like that. It feels like ever since then, his movies have sort of seemed like one another, wouldn't you say?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that the Kill Bill films are the clearest example of what his critics like to ding him for, which is he makes 70s pastiche with little substance. Kill Bill is nothing if not 70s pastiche, and I think there's substance there, but like you said, it is more of a transitional sort of project for him. I think that, you know, all of his films to some degree though are pastiche, which is not a knock against them, but even Pulp Fiction, which captivated audiences and had the right alchemy for whatever reason to really captivate critics as well, I mean, it wears its references pretty proudly on its sleeve.
It's just as cute.
Yeah.
Too.
Yeah. And I don't think he's regressed really at all, because I would point to Inglourious Basterds, which I think contains the best filmmaking of his career, to be honest. You know, scenes of unbearable tension and you know, the opening scene in that is a classic. I think you can isolate the opening scene of Inglourious Basterds as the single best thing that Tarantino's ever done.
I think one thing you can say about this guy, even up to this point, including Django Unchained, and maybe even especially Inglourious Basterds, going all the way back to Pulp Fiction, where that was something that we had never seen before in a movie, and
right.
It was just brand new and fresh to us. I think that everything he's done has been something we've never seen before, and he's defied convention, and he's established new ones. Ever since Kill Bill mm-hmm. and Inglourious Basterds, people, like they did with Pulp Fiction, they're mimicking the guy,
right.
And they've forgotten about Pulp Fiction in some regards, and he's established himself as the guy who brought you Inglourious Basterds, and that's this new standard by which people are hoping his movies will meet.
And yet, Django Unchained in particular seems to be catching a lot of flack from professional critics as being more of the same from Tarantino. Mm. I mean, what do you think about that? Do you think that criticism is fair? Do you think that Django Unchained is more of the same? I mean, I think it's stylistically fairly similar to Inglourious Basterds, and it does share a lot in common with that film, but I don't think that it is unpleasantly similar or repetitive. I don't think it's emblematic of an artist sort of coasting or spinning his wheels.
Well, okay, in that case, you can say Moonrise Kingdom's just more of the same from Wes
Anderson.
Well,
I think a lot of people
right.
do.
Well, exactly, or you can say that, you know, a David Fincher. David Fincher's next movie is just more of the same from him. It's, you know, just the way he makes movies.
Monochromatic digital photography. Yeah, I mean, it's just what the guy does.
Yeah, and that's such a bad thing. Have you been spoiled that much? Like, and I hate to draw it all back to this, but it's like Nick Saban wins another national championship. It's just more of the same from that guy. What a boring coach, you know? Of course, that's a ridiculous criticism because, I mean, you go into a Tarantino movie expecting a Tarantino movie. What else would you expect?
Right.
I don't think we got the same film as Inglourious Basterds. I do feel like since Kill Bill Volume 1, the guy has sort of stuck to a style. Mm-hmm. And I look forward to him changing that up a little bit, where, like you said, you have this 1970s pastiche and you have these references and very on-the-nose dialogue, yet we still walk out of them engrossed and entertained and wanting to see them again. Yeah, that's stupid to me.
I think that the criticism that he's regressed is misplaced. I think it's more that he has progressed in a way that they don't like.
Yeah.
I think you see a clear progression. It's just, it's maybe not what some people want from Tarantino. It's less flashy style and more like good filmmaking, I think.
Right.
He's found a groove, I think. And like you said, people don't really like the groove that he has hit now. And he's sort of stuck to this sort of comic book as a movie style of filmmaking. Or, yeah, like living comic book like Bastards and Django have become. You know, the way people would put it was like, okay, you're having too much fun. Time to get serious again.
Right.
Well, when was he serious? You know, Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs, they're not as... I mean, I wouldn't argue this. They're not as fun, I guess, in the eyes of some people, but they're also not that serious either. Those movies are just as funny as these movies. Honestly, all of Tarantino's movies could be argued as, you know, you can make an argument for them being comedies.
I would actually argue that Django Unchained is a comedy.
Mm-hmm. I could see it either way. Yeah, I mean, it's a hilarious movie, but it's dealing, and this is the same with Inglourious Basterds, it's dealing with subject matter that is not funny at all in any way. And there's no way to even, you know, Tarantino is one of the few who can make a movie in those situations that are funny.
Well, he's indisputably, I think, at this point, a master of mixing tone.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Sort of caterwauling between laughs and, you know, nail-biting tension and horror.
But so do you think that in terms of tone, when it's time to get serious, you think he gets serious?
Well, I mean, look at Jackie Brown.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I mean, even in these movies, when he's mixing tones.
I mean, yeah, I absolutely think so.
With Inglourious Basterds in that opening scene where you say that opening scene is probably the best representation of Nazi atrocity and the Holocaust, I probably felt as tense and worried for characters as I did in something like Schindler's List or The Pianist. I think it was definitely on that level.
Well, and I also would point to the tavern scene in Inglourious Basterds is another very tense, very expertly constructed and quote-unquote serious. I guess, like, I don't really understand applying that term to Tarantino. What do they want him to do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's sort of the fundamental problem is that people don't understand what they want from Tarantino.
Like, even Jackie Brown, that I feel has his best character work and most emotionally resonant moments, even Jackie Brown has its hilarious moments, and even Jackie Brown has its moments of, you know, 70s crime thriller reference
realism and violence. I mean and he mixes those simultaneously, like for instance with the whole Beaumont sequence when Ordell is dealing with him at that moment. It's hilarious because Chris Tucker and Samuel Jackson give hilarious performances, but serious business is also going on and something really takes you out of it.
Or Bridget Fonda's abrupt exit from the film, which is one of the darkest laughs I think in his filmography.
Robert De Niro's exit from the film. I mean, I felt awkward at that moment, you know? So the guy certainly successfully mixes tone. Like you said, he's a master of it. And he's a master in general, I think. The guy does whatever he wants. And every single frame of his films they're all deliberately framed and deliberately focused on doing something specific. And that's something you can't say about a lot of filmmakers.
Right.
The guy he's going to do whatever he wants. I hope he keeps doing what he's doing, because you won't be more entertained at a film than you will be at a Tarantino film these days.
I mean, he makes pure cinema. He doesn't make, you know, transcriptions of good screenplays or stage plays translated to the screen or anything like that. He makes cinema. It might be referential and it certainly pays homage to what came before it, but he sort of seems to distill decades of cinematic history into his own product. It's never not exciting.
I feel like whenever Tarantino has finished a movie and a new one is out, you sort of get this honeymoon stage of his current project from his perspective, where he teases to making another movie or series of movies related to the film you just saw or the one that's out now. Like, he's done it. He says, I'm going to make this prequel, this sequel, this animated series about Kill Bill. I'm going to make this prequel and sequel about the Inglourious Basterds. And now he's come out and said that his next project is one that's halfway written, called Killer Crow, which is about World War II, African-American soldiers back in World War II, where you have this tease to the Inglourious Basterds who are apparently in the story. And this work says the final installment of this revenge fantasy trilogy following Django Unchained. Do you really care where he goes next? Do you want him to always start fresh and get away from the last story he told? Or would you want him to revisit these universes that he's established?
I don't care.
Yeah.
Yeah. I, you know, whatever he wants to do.
You want Tarantino to do what he's excited about doing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You don't want him to be forced to do anything.
Right.
He wouldn't.
Not that he would.
Yeah,
right.
He would never be forced. Sure. Nobody's ever forcing him to do anything he doesn't want.
You go all the way back to Pulp Fiction, man, when the Vega brothers was on the horizon.
Right. It's like, okay, well, that might have been interesting in 1996, but.
No more.
Yeah.
But I bet Michael Madsen could use the work.
Michael Madsen could use the work. Maybe he'll show up in Killer Crow.
Well, the film is still playing nationwide and doing quite well at the box office right now. Django Unchained playing nationwide. Corey, there's a new Peter Jackson, J.R.R. Tolkien, Lord of the Rings movie out in theaters right now, and it just seems like nobody's really excited about it, even though it is making bank. Like,
it's making a lot of money.
Like we had sort of anticipated it would on the last show. That's no surprise, but in terms of the actual quality of the movie, in anticipation, I think, leading up to it, it just felt like nobody was really talking about it. And even though it is making all this money, I'm not really hearing people talk about it as much as I am Django Unchained or even Les Miserables, which is out right now in theaters. The Hobbit is just sort of quietly dominating the box office and dominating the Hollywood economy and industry, as it were. You and I were extremely excited about it because we're such huge fans of this Lord of the Rings trilogy that Peter Jackson gave to us and left back in 2003. So 9 years later, we have another movie. We have another trilogy on our hands, and we finally got to see it. Do you think that all of these reservations people had about Peter Jackson not only returning to Middle Earth in these films or in this universe, do you think that the reservations were also that he'd be rusty and that his heart wouldn't be in it since he hadn't intended to direct them in the first place? Now that you've seen The Hobbit, do you feel like Peter Jackson's heart wasn't in it?
No, I think his heart is very clearly in it, regardless of what you think of the film. I think that many of the complaints that most people are levying at this material are that his heart is perhaps too much into it, and the film is distended and overlong because of it. That's not a complaint that I share, because frankly, critically speaking, I'm not objective here. Like, I love the Lord of the Rings film so much, and I love what Peter Jackson did with those movies. I watch the extended trilogy 3 times a year, it seems like. So it's, you know, I was so excited to see his return that basically the film could have been 3 hours of just hanging out at the Shire in Bilbo's house, and I probably would have been fine with it. I really had a great time with The Hobbit. But, you know, that being said, it's like, I can't deny that critical complaints about this movie could be valid for some people. You know, they might be frustrated by its sort of lack of forward momentum or its length, which I personally don't understand, but I just assume that might be a valid criticism that I just don't care about because I just enjoy this movie so much.
Well, I'll try to be objective, because there are certain things about Return of the King and even Two Towers I wasn't wild about. Fellowship's easily my favorite.
Yeah, it's my favorite too.
It's not even a contest. Yeah. And there are things I love about those second two movies, but yeah, I mean, they're, in terms of the length and in terms of all that is going on and things they try and toggle and some of just like that overdose of special effects that you get, mm-hmm. It's all still great to me, and I remember it fondly. But if I'm being objective here about The Hobbit, all I really can say is I think it's fucking great. Like, nice. I love this movie, yeah. And to me, this recaptures the magic of Fellowship. Mm-hmm. The way the other two movies didn't quite for me, and I would rank, if we're in ranking mode right now, if I'm ranking the Peter Jackson Tolkien movies, this is second for me.
Wow.
Right under Fellowship.
Yeah, I don't think I'd go that far.
Well, but... I had that much fun with it this time.
It's a blast.
And I think, you know, part of it, in a way that's not quite as objective, is that I was ready to be transported back into this Middle Earth again, and I feel like Jackson totally accomplishes that. You know, with the help of guys like Andrew Lesney and Howard Shore, especially. God, when I heard that Shire theme for the first time again after, 9 years, I just felt that charge go through my body again that left me back in 2003 with that last movie. And where I was so excited this time had to do with we're on this adventure with these brand new characters, too. And it felt so personal again. Like, the first movie felt personal to me because it was so focused on Frodo and these nine guys who were on this mission. You got to know them so well, and you felt an attachment to them. So when you lost one of them, even in the first movie, you really felt it, you know, like the way they did. And this one I did too with Bilbo. And I thought Martin Freeman's performance was just excellent. And I have a built-in excitement for Freeman and being a fan of the British Office and a lot of the work that he's done up to this point. It's just great casting, and he really delivers. And the writing here is so great, the way he mixes in the, you know, the old language of Tolkien's text, especially when they get to Rivendell and you have Elrond, played again by Hugo Weaving, just going on and on about the context of it all and the history. And when he's holding up swords and telling you the story of the history of this sword, the Goblin Cleaver, and like, it's awesome. I mean, you have that same mystique and, again, magic and just feeling of the very first movie. And I love the dwarves, too. They're goofy as anything, but I thought it was great. And the action here, the set pieces, God, the photography is amazing. You have one of the great hero shots in the history of movies as Thorin of Oakenshield is walking from this flaming tree during one of these climaxes. And then, you know, I don't want to give too much away here, but I'm sure the people who are going to see this have already seen it. When you saw in Fellowship Gandalf escape from this tower flying on the back of this, like, giant falcon or eagle or not sure what it's called.
Yep.
You have a few of those this time in some of the most gorgeous shots I think I've ever seen on a movie screen. It just all welled up for me again, and I just, by the time it was all over, I couldn't wait for the next one. Just like Fellowship, when Sam and Frodo are walking down that cliff and you can see Mordor in the background there and on the horizon, same thing here.
Yeah. It's just a lot of fun. Yeah, part of the thing about this film is that, you know, unlike The Lord of the Rings, it's not really a straight adaptation job of Tolkien's The Hobbit, which is a fairly slim volume, all things considered. Jackson is drawing into, and this is probably well publicized at this point, but Jackson's drawing into the appendices of The Lord of the Rings and really sort of expanding the scope and the story of The Hobbit to sort of tie it more closely to The Lord of the Rings trilogy, so that it feels like, I guess, more of a direct prequel, rather than just a separate adventure that happened before Lord of the Rings featuring Bilbo. That being said, the most important event that happens in The Hobbit that could lead into The Lord of the Rings is the discovery of the Ring of Power, which takes place in this terrific scene in The Hobbit, probably my favorite scene in the movie, where Bilbo encounters Gollum underneath in the caverns of the Misty Mountains. And Gollum, of course, once again played by Andy Serkis in motion capture technology. The technology has progressed so far since 2002, since the introduction of that character in the Two Towers, that Gollum just, looks still not quite photoreal, but
closer.
Certainly closer.
Yeah.
Certainly a lot closer.
And it was close back then, too.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
And that scene is just... it's almost directly lifted, I think, from the pages of The Hobbit, but it's still terrifically done by, terrifically acted and really amazingly shot. That, of course, happens directly before the grand set piece, the escape from the clutches of the goblin hordes in the Misty Mountains, which is this endlessly inventive and exciting sequence where the 13 dwarves and Gandalf are running through this collapsing structure.
It's just this endless landscape of this goblin cave. It's amazing. I also, where this really could have taken a left turn for the worse, where you have this goblin king,
right,
voiced by, I believe, like Dame Edna,
it's Dame Edna,
who did Bruce in Finding Nemo.
Yep.
That's where I recognized it. I thought he was pretty hilarious. And then you have his little, like, assistant buddy come in when he's delivering
that's
a message.
That's such a Guillermo del Toro invention.
Oh, but dude, like, it reminded me of Jabba's little buddy in Return of the Jedi. I just thought that was so awesome, and I laughed my ass off. The more references to Fellowship and the Lord of the Rings trilogy, the better, to be honest with you. And that's what's going to get people amped about these movies. Like, in the first few minutes of this, you have this scene between Bilbo and Frodo, which is really nice. You get this charge of seeing Elijah back on screen as Frodo. That was great. But then it's essentially the scene right before Frodo's introduction in the Fellowship of the Ring, because he's saying, well, you know, Gandalf's on his way, I'm going to go surprise him. And that's the first time you see those two characters in that movie. It's so cool. And that was a warm feeling I got, at least, because, again, that's my favorite of the Lord of the Rings movies. But not to delve too much into the criticism of this and the hate going around and the Tolkien fatigue, I think, Hollywood and people are experiencing. It's just something I probably will never understand, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I'm with you there. Like, it's just not a feeling that I share. I can't really comprehend anything other than just unchecked enthusiasm about these movies, such that when I saw it at midnight and one of the people I saw it with was like, well, that was okay, I was like, what are you talking about? Okay.
Yeah.
Like, I was on such a high coming out of that movie, I could have watched the next two films right after that, and just to hear, well, I had some problems with it, just at that moment was just...
Yeah, go tell Twitter about your problems. Yeah. You know, like, I'm going to sit here and just revel in it.
I mean, just in the wonderful world creation and just pure moviness of The Hobbit, it's just... It's just a blast.
Pure moviness is a good way to put it. It's something we get too rarely these days. With a film like this and with a film like Django Unchained.
I think that's absolutely apt.
Yeah, this is what movies are all about. They really are. They transport you somewhere. And The Hobbit is guilty of that. Sorry. Yeah. Sorry that The Hobbit had to do that, Hollywood, and people who don't seem to like Lord of the Rings movies for whatever reason anymore, suddenly. Oh, yeah. Sorry,
I think it's very sudden, because as I recall, in 2003 when The Fellowship of the Ring came out, I heard, oh, that movie ended like 7 times, but it was amazing. And then it won 11 Academy Awards. So I don't know where the hate is coming from exactly with that, but it's still amazing. And those movies are still amazing. All 4 of them are still amazing. And I've seen The Hobbit twice. I'll probably see it a few more times in theaters. I'm that enthusiastic about it.
You have the Desolation of Smaug coming. How about that cliffhanger, man?
Yeah, that cliffhanger is pretty great.
So badass.
Yeah.
I mean, good grief. Yeah, I'm super pumped. And there was obviously, from my end, some reservation going into another trilogy in that they decided to make it a trilogy, you know, months before the first film was going to be coming out and releasing. And obviously, yes, it is. For obvious reasons, it's a trilogy, and that's fine and good and everything. But if it just means that it's in the hands of Peter Jackson, I think I'm okay with it.
Well, pacing-wise, I think a lot has been made that this movie covers, like, the first 6 chapters of The Hobbit. Have you read The Hobbit?
No, I haven't.
So there is actually a lot of story left. So after seeing this film and knowing how much of the book is left, and with the possibilities of Jackson's additions to this film and this film series, filling in the blanks and filling in what's only hinted at in The Hobbit, yeah, bring it on. Bring on 2 films. I mean, if anything, certain parts of The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey, feel a little compressed to me, which I don't think is a complaint very many people are going to share, but there are times where I kind of wanted the movie to slow down, because I like the sort of ambling nature of these Tolkien films. I like just the journey, and I like the time spent with these characters. It's just something that I value in these films, and frankly, I guess I can understand why people who aren't as invested in this storytelling and in these books and in these films past would not get the same amount of enjoyment out of this film as I would, but the fact of the matter is, like, bring on an extended cut as far as I'm concerned. I'll be there with bells on.
The movie, I think, is beautiful and fun, and I, you know, it's just one of those things where you forget how much fun you're capable of having at the movies, and The Hobbit is one of those things that reminds you of that. So, and that's out there, folks, and if you haven't seen it, or if you're hating, get out there and watch it. Yeah. Andrew, get out there and watch it.
I might go see it this afternoon. Yeah, after y'all talked about it.
Well, Corey, DVDs, any new ones? I've certainly caught up on a few. I've got 18 movies that I want to see from 2012 before I feel like I can call it a year and formulate a top 10 list, and I watched 2 of those recently, but what's out there that's new?
In the last couple of weeks, obviously, studios are rushing movies out on shelves, or they were rushing movies out onto the shelves before Christmas. So this week, not a lot, but last week you had movies like Arbitrage starring Richard Gere, Red Hook Summer, the new Spike Lee film, Killer Joe starring Matthew McConaughey, directed by William Friedkin, which I think you saw, Premium Rush with Joseph Gordon-Levitt. And then, of course, next week, or in the next couple days, rather, New Year's Eve and New Year's Day, see the release of Rian Johnson's Looper and David Cronenberg's Cosmopolis, two of my favorite films of the year so far.
I did watch Killer Joe last night, and it was a mess. It was just a hot mess of just
a good mess?
It was. It was a great time, but yeah. Man, like, you really feel like you've been through something after you watch that,
yeah,
especially that climax in particular. But talk about the year Matthew McConaughey is having in 2012 after Magic Mike, which I finally saw, and I feel like he deserves Oscar consideration for that role. Mm-hmm. You could say the same thing about Killer Joe. He deserves it for that.
I think Killer Joe's his best performance ever.
Ever.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think he's amazing.
He's
in
full control.
And I saw that for a second time on Blu-ray, and that movie got better. I saw it for the first time in theaters, and I think, like, the first time you see it, you're just sort of, you know, shocked by what you're seeing. But the second time, you know, I think the movie's hilarious, and I thought it was hilarious the first time I saw it too, but the second time, a lot of that sly, dark humor really comes more into focus, and I mean, it really is pretty masterful.
It is, and the other movie I watched today was Paranorman.
Oh yeah, I love Paranorman.
The stop-motion animation movie from the filmmakers who brought you Coraline, which is a lot of fun, but I thought Paranorman was awesome.
Yeah.
And it's one of the best animated movies of the year. By far.
Still my favorite animated film.
Over Brave?
Yeah.
I watched Brave again this week, too, and it holds up for me. So I'm sticking with that. But Paranorman is a worthy contender. If it walked away with the Oscar, then fine. Whatever.
It won't. It didn't make enough money, but...
What can you do?
Yeah.
But it's really good. It has a great message, too. I mean, this is an anti-bullying movie, for one thing, that I think should be shown in schools everywhere, because it's a lot of fun. And I mean, you watch animated movies in schools all the time anyway, but there are some references, I think, that make it PG that are going to prevent people from showing this in schools.
It has one of the slyest little punchlines right near the end that it made me pretty delighted. You know, it's really hilarious, but I think that alone might foment some parental opposition, particularly in this region, unfortunately. But it's a really terrific movie. It's one of my favorites of the year too.
Incredible animation too. Yeah. For my money, the best closing credit sequence of the year, with just some incredible artwork, and then you have a great White Stripes song playing. Over the closing credits.
That of course got your attention.
It did. I mean, it was unexpected, and it fit pretty nicely. But yeah, Paranorman, high recommendation there.
Well, before we close out, do you plan on seeing Les Mis?
Oh, sprung that one on me, man. Right now, oh God, I've got to be honest with you, it's not looking good.
Ever?
If I'm not going to see it in theaters right now, when it's such a major part of the Oscar conversation and the end of the year conversation, if I don't see it now, I'm not sure I'll ever see Les Mis.
Well, as a way of trying to encourage you to do it so we can have a conversation, I'll say that it was not as bad as I was led to believe. In fact, I came away from it actually kind of liking it. Fair deal.
Well, I'll tell you what it's got going for it, at least. This is 40, the new Judd Apatow movie, which I haven't seen yet and which I will see before Les Mis. That's pretty much the only other movie that's out right now, that and Les Mis. And while I've still got some downtime, I'd like to go see some movies.
Yeah.
And if I run out and I decide not to see Django or The Hobbit again, which I will, but again and again, then Les Mis has a good shot.
Well, I think I haven't seen This Is 40 yet either, but I think that you should give Les Mis a shot, if only for the inevitable Oscar conversation that we're going to have.
Yeah.
That certainly seems to factor into the race a bit more than This Is 40, it would seem.
Well, the window is closing, but we'll see.
Yeah. Also, I think in the next couple of weeks, maybe January 4th, I think, sees the wide release of Gus Van Sant's Promised Land.
Yeah.
And Juan Antonio Bayona's The Impossible, with Naomi Watts, the tsunami disaster film. So I think both of those might open, if not here in Tuscaloosa, maybe in Birmingham over the next week. So I'm going to try to catch both of those, and then Zero Dark 30 the week after that. And that seems like it might almost do it for 2012 for me.
Mm-hmm.
See those and This Is 40 and maybe a couple other little documentaries and outliers that I haven't caught up with, like Once Upon a Time in Anatolia.
Holy Motors.
Yeah, Holy Motors. I don't know if I'm going to get around to that, obviously, because of lack of access.
Mm-hmm.
If it pops up in Birmingham, you know, which it won't.
Zero Dark 30 is pretty much, like, in terms of like the big ones out there, is kind of it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm ready.
I think so. I'm ready too.
Well, that should do it for us. We do have a couple of parting shots from the filmnerds.com crew.
This is Graham Flanagan with Aspect Radio, reporting live from the Charlotte Airport. Ever since I saw Django Unchained on Christmas Day, it quickly became what is, in my opinion, the best movie of 2012 so far, unseating the Dardenne Brothers' Kid with a Bike, which held onto the top spot for quite a long time. And I still have a couple of key movies to see this year, especially Zero Dark Thirty, but right now Django was absolutely the most fun I've had at a movie in 2012. And that being said, I wanted to highlight what I perceive to be, in my opinion, the best performance of 2012, which is in Django Unchained. And it's not Christoph Waltz or Leonardo DiCaprio. Those guys have been getting all the Oscar buzz. It's got to be Samuel L. Jackson. I think it's an absolutely unbelievable performance and a surprise, certainly, because his character has not been featured in much of the marketing materials or the trailers or clips. So when he shows up as a force of nature late in the film and plays a very substantial role, and I seriously believe it's one of Samuel L. Jackson's best, if not his best performance of his entire career. It's definitely going to be a controversial character in a lot of people's opinion. The type of character that he plays, some might call it an Uncle Tom type character, some might even go worse than that in their description of it, but obviously it's one that Tarantino felt deserved to be in the story, and obviously Samuel L. Jackson was up for it, and I think that the results are excellent. I highly recommend this movie, and I hope hopefully the Academy will give him some consideration come Oscar time. From the Charlotte Airport, this is Graham Flanagan for Film Nerds and Aspect Radio.
This is Craig in Nashville. Hey, what's up with all the Les Mis hate everywhere? Some complaints I've heard are that the camera moves too much and that there are too many close-ups. What Tom Hooper has done is expanded the process and technique of adapting a musical. What Tom Hooper hasn't done was make out with your mother while his friends locked you in the trunk of a car. Tom Hooper made an unconventional, though completely working, musical. No doubt if he had made it more straight-laced, the critics would have panned it for being too bland. And what's up with all the Hobbit hate? Some say that it's trying too hard to be like Lord of the Rings, and some say that it feels too disconnected from Lord of the Rings. What Peter Jackson did was attempt to explore the frontiers of filmmaking beyond the world of the overused and overhyped 3D. What Peter Jackson hasn't done was instigate a riot in order to have a legitimate reason to lobotomize you. Peter Jackson is adapting Tolkien's work beyond just The Hobbit, and he is doing so with a fun and entertaining film. Hooper and Jackson are what's good about film today. They're doing more than just the status quo, so people need to stop getting so offended. They're not Danny Glover in The Color Purple or William Zabka in The Karate Kid. One day you'll all understand. As for me, I remain ahead of the curve.
Hey guys, this is Matt Scalise with my parting shot for this week. While the rest of the Film Nerds crew will be catching up on the big Oscar contenders over the next few weeks, I'll be headed to Florida to cover the national championship game as part of that, you know, day job thing I have going. But as any good film nerd, I've got a few great movie recommendations to get you ready for the big game between two of history's greatest teams, Alabama and Notre Dame. Now, sadly, there's a dearth of great football movies, despite that game being really America's chosen sport over the last century. But I do have a handful that I want to bring to your attention. Typically, from the early days of football, when people were still having some fun with this game and it was still trendy and sort of part of the pop culture. One in particular that stands out to me is an excellent Marx Brothers comedy from 1932, Horse Feathers. A lot of good early football gags and puns in here, obviously, but a couple of fun actual football sequences that takes advantage of the inherent physical comedy of the sport of football. Another good one to look for, from 1936, a movie called Pigskin Parade. Now, certainly, this is a movie that doesn't take the sport quite so seriously. It's a musical, but there are some great numbers throughout here that sort of take off on football and even sort of have that fight song feel to it, particularly one from a very young Judy Garland, which I believe this was her very first appearance on film. And one other I want to throw in there from 1936, Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times. It's not a movie about football, but there is a great football-related gag that comes near the end of the movie that you should keep your eye out on. So definitely try any of these movies. They'll get you in the spirit for the great traditions that come along with bowl season. But whatever you do, don't watch Rudy. He was offsides anyway.
Until next week, I'm Ben Flanagan.
And I'm Corey Kraft. This is Aspect Radio. Thanks for listening.